Welcome back, everyone, to Progressively Incorrect. My name is Zach Rochelle, and I'm your host. I am so excited today to be bringing you to one of the schools I actually work with, which I consider like a lighthouse school in this sort of science of learning landscape. It's Inwood Leadership Academy. We're going to talk about what that is and where that's located. And we have a ton of folks coming on in just a moment on the other side of my screen who are going to be able to speak to all the amazing things that they are doing. But first, we have to talk about some of the upcoming opportunities for you and sponsorships. The first thing to know is that John Catt Educational is an education publisher that published my book, Just Tell Them, The Power of Explanations and Explicit Teaching. If you want to get your dream idea into a book and published by the finest education publishers out there, go contact John Catt Educational and Alex Sharratt. I will give you links to that in the show notes, including all of their books and their catalog of amazing evidence-informed education books. The other thing I really want to highlight is actually what this podcast is sort of launching, which is the Explicit Teaching Institute in New York City at Inwood Leadership Academy, led by me, the host of this podcast. We're going to be doing a week-long institute in the greatest city in the world, focused on the topics that are in my book, as well as the more expanded realm of explicit teaching and science of learning, evidence-informed education. I will put the links and registration in the show notes. Go check those out. Now, without further ado, let's get right into the episode and start talking with my guests. I'm going to start with the leaders of Inwood Leadership Academy. We've got Christina and Bianca on the call. Christina, Bianca, how are you doing?
Hi, Zach. We're doing great.
So nice to see you both, although wish we could be in person. Let's talk about Inwood as a neighborhood, as a place, and also as the school. What are we talking about when it comes to the schools that you're running? Let's start with Christina.
Yeah, so Inwood Academy is a school. It's a charter school in Upper Manhattan in New York City. We serve a population that is predominantly from the Dominican Republic, so it's an immigrant community. We have over 90% of our students are free and reduced lunch. And we actually have three separate schools, a middle school, an elementary school, and a high school, three separate sites. But we do see ourselves as one K through 12 school. And we have been into research since the day we opened in 2010. And so we've just been learning and growing and trying to apply that to our school setting.
Bianca, what role do you play in all this? You know, you working with staff, you're very hands-on in terms of the instruction and the vision. Tell me about what you do.
So my official title is Chief Schools Officer, but really I'd call myself the Chief Servant Officer. And the reality is that my job really is to ensure K-12 alignment. So like Christina shared, we have three different sites, an elementary, a middle, and a high site. But the goal is that we have a very coherent through line from when students enter in kinder to when they graduate in 12. And so what that looks like is I work very closely with the site leadership to ensure that our instructional practices, our curricular resources, and our school culture all feel really cohesive and streamlined and aligned K-12. And so that manifests itself in our instructional strategies, which have been very much the intention has been to keep it very research-based, and you've helped us a lot with that, Zach.
Well, I don't know. You guys are extremely humble, because I feel like for listeners right now, like this school is just an amazing place to visit, regardless of like which campus you visit. And so we're going to start by talking about some of these systems that I think people need to take note of, including some of like kind of the school-wide systems that have been established. Maybe take us through these. I know that you often like to highlight what you're doing in reading intervention. Christina, maybe start there.
Yes. So we jumped early onto the science of reading approach to ensuring that students can read at grade level. And I think the unique thing about us is that we started as a middle school. We didn't have an elementary school. And so our kids weren't learning how to read from a traditional approach. They were very much using a whole language approach before they got to Inwood, because that's the predominant curriculum used in New York City public schools until recently. And so We had to, when they got it to us in fifth grade or sixth grade or seventh grade, because we get kids at all grade levels, really go back to the basics. And so we had to focus first on ensuring that kids have the basic skills. So you'll see kids in intervention classes. We specifically use Wilson and Just Words, sounding out words and really diving deep into vocabulary. And these are done in the school day. It's built into a child's schedule based on the assessments that we do at the beginning of the year that indicate whether or not a child needs those kinds of interventions. So that was really the first big step. But I will say that we have, as a school, been very passionate also about our curriculum from the first day. And so that's been a journey for us as Common Core came and then kind of went. And so we've had to adjust based on, the requirements of the state through our testing programs. But we have always also had that as a real mainstay, and making sure that our curriculum was aligned to the science of really the science of learning, not even the science of reading. And that meant making sure it was background knowledge focused. Making sure that it had direct instruction elements built into it. And so that's another big piece of what we do here at Inwood.
It's interesting that coming out of New York State, from what I know, it's just sort of like a battleground, it feels like that every year there's just like I recently saw a lot of superintendents and leaders had to go to a New York State kind of some sort of consortia or whatever, and it was really around the profile of the learner and creating like this sort of inquiry-based kind of mindset in schools. And just before there was a big fiasco around like math and the math sort of briefs that came out in New York State and all, it just seems like there's all, like, it's like the other California almost. It's like there's just constant barrage of initiatives that just contradict the most recent one. How do you sort of navigate that as a school leader? Maybe we'll go over to Bianca because she's interested in like kind of the cohesion and the alignment and when it comes to all the different campuses. How do you navigate sort of those external demands and the fact that you also just like want to put on the best program in the city?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. I also will lean on Christina to some degree because historically, right, that's been the reality for Inwood Academy, right? Is that with the times we've had to kind of change with new mandates or, new requirements, whether they were a change to a state exam or a Regents requirement, which are these like end of year state assessments, or right, like Christina referenced the Common Core and what that meant in shifts to our program and curriculum. And I think we've kind of went with that for, because that was what was being demanded of us at the time. That being said, a few years back, we read Natalie Wexler's book. And it really, the knowledge gap, and it really affirmed our experience and validated our experience and reminded us that there is something that is tried and true, and that is all linked to the science of learning, which includes explicit instruction and really ensuring that some of these high instructional practices are being what's like is the thing that's happening in the classroom. And so I think where we are now is it doesn't matter where the state moves. I say that, in the most humble way, but it doesn't matter where the state moves. I think we know what's true. We know what brain research is telling us now, and that's what we're going to stick to. So we recognize curriculum as a resource, but we also know that we will show integrity to it while also not complete fidelity because we will be faithful. And show fidelity to the science of learning and not necessarily a curricular resource or a standard, as opposed to really how the brain learns and teaching that way.
Love it. And so aligned with the sort of the reading intervention piece that kind of came in early on, it was sort of like it kind of fits out the story of the United States right now. It's like sort of early adopters of reading. Since then, what are some of the pieces you've been putting in place? Maybe Christina can answer that one.
Yes, so curriculum is easy in some places and really hard in other places, right? I think we've acknowledged that high school is a much tougher place to find the research, the curriculum resources that are necessary to really ensure that teachers have a clear scope and sequence that they can wrap their minds around that ensures that there's retrieval, ensures that there's these key strategies or direct instruction involved. And I think K through eight, there are, especially today, a lot more curriculum resources that we can say we feel really good about. And so I think what we've had to do is align instructional practices across K through 12, and then teachers can recognize if there's a missing piece in the curriculum, or if there just isn't because it's, a kind of an obscure class curricular content, I guess, in the upper grades. Is there retrieval happening? Well, if there's not, that's okay because we have, lesson plans called our week at a glances that ensure that a teacher puts that in. And so we call them the WAGs, week at a glance. And those are our lesson plans, and they're clearly aligned to the science of learning. And it helps teachers identify where they may need to fill in a gap to ensure that the learning is consolidated. We've also started to use StepLab for our instructional practices coaching. So our coaches are really clear about what they're looking for when they walk into a classroom. And that's been a really great tool for our coaches and for our teachers to know, okay, where's the cold calling? Where are the exit tickets? Where are And so with the WAGs and the instructional coaching through StepLab, we've been able to modify and adjust where, the curriculum might not provide what we needed.
And what I'm hearing here too is you've name dropped some of like the key, some of the key strategies we talk about on this podcast. But what one of the experiences I have going to schools, especially schools that, well, they just struggle to retain staff, and so there's a lot of turnover and stuff like that, is that they really have a hard time establishing like a shared language around effective instruction because of this retention problem, because their PD is not in place. And so maybe you can speak to how you kind of create that kind of that the professional development or like whole school kind of wraparound support to create buy-in and understanding around some of these things, which are relatively new to a lot of schools. Bianca, maybe you want to take that one?
Sure, yeah. I mean, Christina mentioned StepLab, and I would say while it is a tool we use for coaching, it offers tons of professional development. And I would argue that coaching is a form of professional development. And so it, really the way the platform is used is that our coaches meet with teachers, they observe them, they then give them feedback. But what I really love about StepLab is that it also includes opportunity for them to see a model. And so they are able to watch a video on a teacher who's modeling that best practice. And then from that, the coach would then rehearse with their coachee, where again, really adds to that teacher's professional development. And outside of that, we do professional development for our teacher apprentices. So those are teachers that are, in the making. And Christina meets with them monthly and, sits down with them for almost the entirety of a day and really is laying out a lot of these instructional practices. We have our in service at the beginning of the year, 4 full-day PDs throughout the course of the year and some half-day PD days kind of sprinkled in throughout the year, where we do try to kind of discuss instructional practices, but as it suits the trends at a particular site. So, right now they're talking about providing student feedback in real time at the high school, as that's meeting a need that we're seeing at the high school after conducting walkthroughs. So, that's kind of what professional development looks like outside of when we do send people out. Or, research ed made its way to New York City, and we were very grateful for that. So we took a team of teachers not only to present, but also to participate and learn. And I think when you hear from our teachers later, you're going to hear about the books that they've read and how they've engaged in some of this research-based best practice through these really powerful texts that are out there and available to anybody.
I want to tell like just a quick sign or whatever, an indication that I had going into I guess it's the middle school building was the first building I went to. You go into Christina's office and like the whole office is like covered in like curriculum resources and books and things like that. And Christina and Bianca, who you've just heard from, like know all of these things that we're talking about. Like they actually have opened the pages of these books, and they don't rely like a lot of leaders do on like someone in the building to take that and someone to take that. Of course, they distribute some, you know, that some of this knowledge, but they themselves learn about like what's coming up, and they sort of self coach and self educate. And it's really powerful. I think how into this you both are. You're like on text basis all the time with me, which I think is really funny. And then just like with your teachers and sort of caring for them and leading, I think leading the way. It's really impressive. One of the new things you mentioned to me is I guess is a bit controversial. It's around technology. You started to see it in a different way. It possibly is interfering in some ways with what you want to do as from a cultural standpoint, from an instruction standpoint. Where are you at, Christina, when it comes to like te how technology plays a role in the educational program at Inwood?
Yes. So I think, it goes back to the problem with high school curriculum resources. We have a real dearth at the high school level, and a lot of the curriculum, maybe 15 years ago or so, really shifted to an online platform, and you couldn't even get the books. You couldn't find a textbook. And that was so frustrating because navigating a platform, not only for the teachers as well as the students, was hard, right? And I think that if you didn't have a device in your hand, what were you going to do? And so, having these excerpts of passages, short stories, which, everybody loves a good short story, but where's the novels? How are we ensuring that kids are annotating texts? You annotating a text on a Chromebook is truly insane. Like, it's an insane process. And where is that then allowing students to consolidate the information they're learning? It's just not. So I think for us, technology, and then of course we had COVID, which we had no choice, right? Like, once again, mandates didn't allow us to do what we wish we could do in those years. And it did create a shift. And so teachers got reliant on certain resources that were online, and we had to bring them out of it. And so we use technology. It's not that there's no technology in our school. We absolutely have Chromebooks. We have all the things, right? New York State now has a testing program that is online. We got to teach kids how to take tests online. That's just facts. But when we are in class and we're learning and there's new content, you will rarely see Chromebooks or any sort of technology within the school, within that classroom setting, I should say. And we have purchased more textbooks over time. We have purchased, so for instance, we use Amplify Science program at the middle school and the elementary school. And a lot of that is online, but you can purchase the workbooks. So guess what we did? We purchased the workbooks and we use the workbooks. And then when it's time to do, what they call their labs, those are online, right? So you're looking at the pictures, you're pulling, you're doing the stuff online, right? But we prefer those resources in the hands of kids because we know that that helps when they're writing with a pen or a pencil. It's going to get that learning to go deeper. And the other thing is our students have not had cell phones. And so we've had a no cell phone policy pretty much from the beginning. I think at the beginning there weren't. In 2010, kids didn't really have that many cell phones, so we didn't really think about it. But then once it became a thing, we're like, no. And so we use different methods to ensure students just don't have cell phones from the beginning of the day until the end of the day. And so you won't see those either in classes.
Excellent. And when I think about students in your school, like they're also like talking to each other a lot in the hallways. They're talking with their teachers. Before we go over to our panel of teachers in just a moment, I kind of wanted to touch on, I think what's most evident from a great school standpoint, and what's most evident from visiting Inwood is just like the kids are just really joyful. They're happy to be at school, and their brothers and sisters come up to the next level and join them in the next level of the school, which I think speaks to like how the parents appreciate the model. You mentioned culture multiple times. How do you cultivate that? Is that just something that's built into the fabric of the neighborhood, or is that something that you can do with intention? Bianca, the floor is yours.
Well, I want to name that both Christina and I also, while we are employed at Inwood Academy, have also opted into bringing our children to Inwood Academy. So our kids are students of this school because we believe so much in what it stands for. And I would say the culture of a school begins with its mission. And that is true for Inwood Academy. But if I were to sum it down to our tagline, right, our tagline is belong, grow, lead. That IAL is a place where kids belong, a place where they grow in character and in their academics, but also a place where they can lead and become leaders and ch agents of change in their community. And we stand by that. And so that means that when you have that as your foundation, you then the rest is just the fun part, right? Which is where you build that through programs like our advisory program or giving students leadership opportunities like student council or peer group connections where older kids get to mentor younger kids. We're really lucky now that we have these three sites. So we even have like sports clinics where our sports team comes and they coach the younger kids. But we stand by that. We stand by IAL being a community where kids feel belonging. And, you know, shout out to all the educators. And I know that they'll probably disagree with me on this one, but we have the best kids in the world at Inwood Academy. But I think that that's what would have to be true in order for you to have a good culture is that you believe that your kids are the best kids in the world and that they belong under your care. And therefore, you're going to create an environment that is welcoming and safe and a place where kids can flourish. And when they feel that and when they sense that, they then replicate that and they create that culture for the rest of their peers and classmates and students that follow. And then families feel that and they're starting to sense that difference at home. And then they start telling their cousins to come to your school. Or, you know, their nieces and nephews end up coming to their school. And we're at a place where some of our alumni are sending their children to our school. And so it has to begin, I would say, Zach, with the mission. And then from there, you build that. And when you really believe it, then it is how you then enact it every day. And kids feel that. And they also then, you know, spread that same positive school culture outward.
Well, that was beautiful. So we're going to turn over now to the teachers who are making this happen and who are sort of that really know the kids at an instructional level and a day-to-day basis and how they use some of these things, some of these structures that have been put into place. So I'll go on over now to Ciari and Janitza, who are teachers. How are you both doing?
Good, we're good. Thank you for having us on, Zach.
So we know that like Inwood is a school that's really been emphasizing like learning science topics and principles. Maybe we'll start with Ciari. What are some of these things you've been implementing in your classroom, like routines and things like that you find to be really strong and effective?
I just want to start by saying that when we began this journey, Christina invited a group of teachers. She opens it up and she said, "Hey, anyone interested in learning about how kids learn?" And so I signed up. We started reading Uncommon Sense Teaching by Barbara Oakley. And in doing so, we learned about the science of learning and honestly unlearned some other things. So you guys mentioned curriculum earlier. I'm a math teacher. And so the big push for discovery, exploratory teaching painted me as like the guide on the side versus like I'm in front, I'm teaching you, I'm modeling. So it took some shifting when I was learning. And so when we were looking at in common sense teaching, the biggest thing that stood out was the limitation of working memory. So the biggest thing I do as a math teacher is design lessons that protect this working memory. So, you know, starting by eliciting background knowledge, followed by short, focused modeling, and direct instruction. The biggest mistake that we see the teachers make in classrooms is teaching the nice to know with the need to know. And so showing students what to pay attention to and why it works, the highlighting, right, is another strategy, highlighting what is essential. It tells the brain, I need to remember where this is So let me put it somewhere close and easily accessible, right? If you tell kids, this is what you have to remember, this is the important thing, this is the meat, instead of letting them figure it out, right? Because they're novices, they will most likely not do that, right? So instead of setting them up for failure in that way, shifting to highlighting more direct instruction. Also, strategic implementation of guided practice, but also interleaved practice, right? Where they get to learn how to choose strategies versus following steps, right? Because eventually they do need to learn how to do that. Highlighting, direct instruction, implementation of interleaving, listening background knowledge, all that good stuff.
Love it. What about you, Janitza? What have you been trying out?
Well, we were reading this book. There was a lot of different practices, and I needed to make sure I chose one because we can't do it all. So I try to be very intentional when I integrated retrieval practices, and I chose spacings and interleaving, but mostly spacing with explicit teaching, because as a history teacher, we give a lot of information. We provide with the students with a lot of different facts, and it's just too much to remember. So I had to figure out what is the best method that I'm seeing here that I can really use in my classroom that can maybe help our students just understand what they're learning. And I noticed that spacing did work best for my course, and I continue to use it. And I no longer teach U.S. history, I now teach government and econ, and I still see that spacing is still a really form, is a really good retrieval practice that allows the students to bring back like all the information that they might have had, might have learned, I want to say months ago. And I could retrieve that information through spacing in their do nows. I can do it through class discussions. I can do it through CERs with shoulder pointer discussions. Whether they learn something a week before or months before, these are material practices that I like to use and I've noticed have worked.
And it seems like for all of these, you need some level of like support or approval around kind of adopting these. Because I was just thinking about when you incorporate spacing in like a history class, it can feel like perhaps to an observer or whatever that you're not covering as much content because you're going back and making sure we revisit past information. I think over time you end up covering the same amount because you because you end up like buying time later because the kids aren't forgetting. But however, in the moment maybe like you're doing these strategies and they might seem weird on to an outsider. So like what kind of support do you get like or encouragement to like really innovate and try these out even when you might like fail at first? I'm curious, maybe Ciara, you take that one.
So here, student need was the biggest driver. Pre-COVID, we had IM, which illustrative in mathematics, which is being adopted by the city and the state. And while kids could perform during the unit, we saw that they quickly forgot the content later, the learning wasn't clear. So I realized that asking students to discover concepts while holding multiple ideas overworked their working memory. And as teachers, right, we sat and we're like, okay, why can't kids think critically, or why aren't they struggling productively, right? And so understanding and in learning about more about the science of how kids learn, I was like, wait, they can struggle for sure, but they can't struggle productively until they have that background knowledge, until we're setting up a structure where they're constantly retrieving things and have the tools to, like, the puzzle pieces to put together, right? So it wasn't the student that didn't know how to struggle productively. It was the puzzle I was giving them, right? I wasn't giving them enough pieces, right? So, right, I don't know if I answered your question or if it's
Well, like
clear,
for
but.
math, for example, like you've now chosen the dark arts of teaching things directly, which is like goes counter to like what a lot of people say math education should be like. Are you getting like the support from the school to be able to try things out and be able to test and iterate and get to the sweet spot so you can really nail, like you just said, there's this weird space of like kids effortfully trying something, but before they sort of start failing and blaming themselves. So yeah, what does that support kind of look like from a teacher's side?
I mean, one, For sure, we get the support, and always. I do feel that, like, even when they bring something up, they give us the space to say, okay, like, what do you think? You know, your student's the best. So, I know everywhere isn't like that. So, I'm definitely thankful to work somewhere where I get that support from my coach. I get that support from administration. Their asks are very clear, right? So, I'm understanding what it is that's being asked of me, and when I do, want to implement something, they're definitely like, all right, let's look at the data, right? We're very data driven. So, what is the data saying? So, to answer your question, we do get the support, and it looks like we look at the data to kind of inform how that decision went.
Love it. And Janita, we keep mentioning this, the data. For me, that's like what it means to be like student-centered is just like actually look at what they're doing and whether or not they're responding rather than like making some stray hypothesis like based on, I don't know, who they are and what they're like and their motivational state or whatever else. Let's look at how they're performing. So how does that apply to some of these strategies you mentioned? You mentioned like interleaving spacing and retrieval. What do you look at to be like, okay, it's time to adjust my teaching?
So the first thing I noticed with the students is that they weren't struggling specifically with the exposure of all the information because we all get exposed to a bunch of information throughout every single day. They were really more struggling with retention and transferring that information into different times, into different content that we're teaching or just other things. So that's what made me realize, like, okay, I do need to change some of the ways that I'm teaching because I need to make sure that they're able to use this information. Not just for this one classwork, not just for today's lesson, but for the future as well. Like, how can they make those connections? So that's when I saw that spacing worked really well because one quote that I remember from the Uncommon Sense teaching was the act of forgetting creates the need to remember, something like that. And we need to have a lot of the times we don't allow our kids. We allow our kids to forget, and then we allow them to forget too much to a point where then they won't be able to retrieve that information. We need to constantly try to retrieve that information, whether it's one way or the other. Because a lot of times they'll look at something, they'll be like, I remember this, but they don't know how to connect it. So that was my biggest red flag that I'm like, okay, I really need to figure out how to fix this.
And when you were at Research Ed, you both presented with some other teachers around sort of like your kind of action research, kind of proof of product of like how this is working. Could you maybe tell us like what the results of those tests were that were derived from these learning science principles? Ciari, let's go with you.
Yeah, so we collected data. We looked at, I know in math, we looked at a set of problems, a set of skills, and we kind of tracked their performance after using these strategies. And we saw that there were fewer strategy selecting errors, right? Because we were clear, the kids remembered, oh, my teacher said this about that thing, and to not look out for, look out for that. And so understanding that my teacher voice was still living in their head was like, oh, yeah, I need to make sure that I keep talking, right? And not just let them talk to each other, but I also have to talk and have that direct instruction. So seeing that they were able to tell me, yeah, miss, you said this, I was like, oh, okay, like they're remembering because I made it a big deal, right? And it's not like, oh, whatever you want, just like explore. No, it was like, this is the thing. This is the big deal. You got to remember it. And they were remembering. We saw a lot of strong recall, relied less on the reteaching. So, retrieval, yes, but I didn't have to start from the ground up because I was explicit the first time. And we mainly saw students who struggled the most benefit the most. So it definitely narrowed the achievement gap in our class because we have some high flyers and we had some low lows. And so we saw that the students who struggled the most were the ones to kind of be lifted by that change.
I feel that the science of learning movement, in quotations, the heart of it is focused on helping kids who struggle. I have to believe that. However, it's possible to interpret some of the events and some of the things we go to is like, they're like it's like taking place in a private school. You know, a lot of people are working in sort of more affluent areas, and it's possible to think of like the science of learning as like a nice to have for a school that doesn't have to, actually work and meet kids where they're at in areas in areas that are of more relative disadvantage. I'm just curious, like you mentioned that is that sort of the underlying belief as well that we need to mention? There's something of a social justice element to just effective teaching that kind of permeates your professional development and sort of the mission that's there. I guess that's such a leading question, but maybe you can unpack that for me. Maybe put it into your own words, Ciari.
Yeah, for sure. I have heard that as well. I've heard that, yeah, you need that because the kids you're working with are blank, right? It's nice, but we don't need that, right? We don't need the science of students learning. The issue at times is the background knowledge component, and so that is the science, right? So if I am the my high flyers are the ones that have that background knowledge, and my low ones are the ones that I have to re-expose them, and it's the science, but they're at a different place in that sequence.
I'm thinking you've got the kids who already know the math, and so they're ready to start to dive into sort of more sort of problems that have kind of extraneous information. Maybe there are kind of some tricks in there. They've got all this background knowledge, and a lot of times it's because, frankly, they got like tutoring at Kumon in some of these schools, or their parents just work with them on stuff. But then you've got other kids that really need this incremental approach that allows them to embed that initial understanding so they can apply it. And it just feels like if you have to make a choice, you make the choice in favor of teaching everybody, and not the kids that already like are kind of teacher proof.
I will say also something that we saw. I mean, we visited schools as well. Some of these private schools have more homogenous groups, right? When it comes to level, right? So if we had all students that were low at the school, every student that walked in through the door was low, we would be able to teach to that, right? If we had every student in this class be high, right? We would be able to teach to that. But the struggle, right, with teaching urban education, public, charter, is that you get them all. You don't just get to weed out the ones that don't serve or make your job easy, right? So it's very easy to teach when most of your students are like homogenous, right, at homogenous levels. So we have the challenge of teaching, like you said, everybody. So that's the biggest difference. I mean, with private, they're just all pretty much on the same
And
level.
did you see some effects with like motivation when it came to, because and often there's this double penalty on kids that struggle. It's not only that it's not only that they're behind in terms of what they know and their skill set. It's also that has created this vicious cycle of them starting to hate school and being really having a bad attitude towards it because of their continuous failure in front of their peers, in front of their teachers, and so on. So has adopting more of an explicit instruction approach that enables you to embed these important foundational understandings that can get them there, has that improved? You've seen sort of kids buy into the process and their motivation?
I can answer this. So, as somebody who taught like a region-based course in New York State, I've noticed like as the years progressed, like me, when I started doing the retrieval practices and I started using these in my classrooms, I went in teaching all of the students. I wasn't thinking about, oh, I'm going to do this just because I have L students, I have kids with IEPs, I have kids who just came into this country. No, my goal was I'm going to teach everybody. And I do have to say, like, when it comes to data, and using these retrieval practices, students who are quote unquote the ones who would struggle did just as well as those who did unquote unquote won't struggle, which was surprising to me and very encouraging for them because it showed them like, oh, I was able to pass these state exams without needing that lower limit that the state usually gives me. And it gave them a lot more, like it gave them pride within themselves. It made them feel like they could actually continue this doing this. And I would think that it was because of these practices that we tried. And I say this because I teach the same cohort this year. I moved up with them and I started doing explicit teaching from the get-go. As now they're in their senior year, and usually their senior year, you see motivation go way down. But nobody ever like everybody was great. And a lot of the students were able to understand. The material, they were able to connect it from different units. And even now that we moved on to our economics, students are still mentioning like, oh, this relates to government because of because I remember I learned this before, which was crazy for me because I don't even have to ask for it anymore. They tend to start retrieving the materials themselves on their own without me even doing it anymore, because I guess I've been doing this since their junior year, and maybe they've seen that connection. I don't know if they're doing it on purpose, but they're definitely retrieving.
That's awesome. Maybe speak a little bit more, Janitza, to your action research project. I want to give that a bit of a spotlight.
So for our courses, we do a lot of CERs and short responses because it's a history course, and we always love that evidence. So we want to make sure that the students are able to put it into place. So we do focus on a lot of short constructed responses. Unit assessments are very high on vocabulary because we do have a lot of different vocabularies. And so one of the assessments that I've been able to use, and I've noticed that it has helped our students, is vocabulary. Vocabulary is one of those things that a lot of our students struggle with. And even as adults, like sometimes I feel like very dumb when I'm around people. I'm like, oh my gosh, they're using these big words. So when I'm thinking the students feel the same way probably when us teachers are talking. So when they are able to use these, when these new vocabularies are introduced, I always make sure that they have to implement a lot of these new terms into their writing so they continue to use them over and over again with this repetition. So that it just becomes like a nature to them. And then when they do see them maybe 2 to 3 months later, or maybe just a week later, they're no longer struggling with the vocabulary, and they're able to just understand the material a lot better. And when they're reading something on their own, they're no longer feeling like they're inadequate and they're not able to understand something at grade level, because they're like, oh, I remember what this term is. And because I remember, I've learned it before, and they're able to make those connections.
Love it. Well, I noticed that when we talk about some of the planning that's taken place, this year has been a great year for my friend Gene Tavernetti, because he's had a lot of people adopting just a simple lesson planning process that can help teachers kind of have a routine in place that always seems to land. If you just follow this structure, it can gradually release kids into the final independent practice, and you can get a lot more success. Tell me, what impact has been using sort of this FAST framework, the Gene Tavernetti FAST framework? How has that impacted your process, and how has that optimized your planning?
Maybe I'll just speak to this real quick, because I think for our teachers, they don't know necessarily explicitly that what we're using is Teach Fast, which is the focus
It's on there, actually.
It's on the
Wait,
WAG. We
every
see it.
WAG
We
has
see
the
it.
FAST linked on it. Actually, I don't know if you realize that they linked it on there, but on the top of our WAG, we have the FAST Focus Adaptable Structured Teaching link. And so, I mean, I've had to click on it because I'm like, what's this? So yes, Christina, we even though you haven't explicitly gone through it, somebody put it on there. And I'll tell you, at least some teachers were like, what's that? Clicked on it, and someone
There's a hyperlink,
summarized.
and it
Yeah, there's
sends
a
us to a
hyperlink.
document you own.
I really like that it puts the emphasis, right? It starts out with what are the key topics? It clarifies. I look at it, and in 3 seconds, I know, okay, what are students storing in their long-term memory? What needs to stick? So it makes the core learning apparent and very visible. And that's for me, because we've seen different planners, they all have similar things, but the emphasis on it's fast. Like, what is the thing that needs to be learned? Lessons feel tighter. They feel more purposeful, and students retain more without the constant review. Again, we all know that like there has to be retrieval and all of this stuff, but the way that we plan, I think now that we're using the FAST framework, reflects more the research that we've been doing.
Love it. How about you, Janitza?
It helps me organize learning. I'm a big fan of like back lesson, the UBDs, backwards designs plan. And so I feel like with using the UBDs and then putting it into WAGs, it just helps me organize all that learning that the students need to have. And I can see all the core learning targets and design them appropriately, and then be able to use any different forms of retrieval practices within that. And then it just allows me to look at everything as a whole for the week, and then I can always go back and see what I need to either fix or take out or what worked, what didn't work. So it's a good organization tool.
And I just think that's something that's been missing from some of these discussions. It's been on my mind is like, we talk about mini whiteboards, we talk about brain dumps, and they're like these all these isolated like strategies that are extremely powerful on their own because that's how the research considers them. Like we research this one strategy at a time. But then like how do you weave them together into this coherent thing that you can replicate for 180 days. That's why I feel it's funny how lesson planning is just like the least innovative sounding thing you could say, but I don't know. I just think it's incredibly powerful to weave it together the right way rather than having all these isolated activities. Would you say that's kind of been your experience actually implementing it?
Yeah, for sure. The first thing I think of is, the plates, the tri plates, the plates that have like the three little things, right? Versus having a bowl where you just toss things together. You're not sure if you have enough of this, too much of that. And so what this does is it separates it so that we are making sure that these strategies that could pertain more to this thing are in the right category that, or that it's not missing from the plate, right? And losing the nutritional value. So having it separated like that is very helpful because, like you said, there are tons of strategies that we can use. I feel like it's a buffet, right? And what we're doing is that this is a good plate where we can go to that buffet that we have and just take and put into the right place. And it actually feels easier because I'm like, all right, I'm just putting this here, putting this here, putting this there, but the structure is there. So we really like this formatting. One thing that we are going to be focusing on very soon is the data portion of it. So just having teachers, yes, we have the learning there, but what are we actively looking for in the class? So giving a space for teachers to pre-plan, okay, this is a lesson on this topic, this is the certain thing I'm looking for during this time. And just being more intentional with the data response part of it, but we love it.
Perfect. Well, I have had such a great time talking with you both and also with Christina and Bianca. I think you all are on the cutting edge when it comes to the science of learning. And I think folks should consider visiting the school, coming to the Explicit Teaching Institute, going to your talks when they're at Research Ed and so on. I think Inwood is a school network to follow and to be aware of. It's just been so great to work with all of you. And listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to Progressively Incorrect. Please pass this around to a principal or to a superintendent, to a colleague, and get this podcast out there and give it a 5-star rating on the platform of your choosing. Thank you so much for tuning in again. Take care.